Garion began to have some hope at that point. If Saenedra was willing to banter with them, it was a fair indication that she did not take her supposed intimations of her own incipient demise all that seriously. He did, however, wish that he could get that knife away from her.
"During the course of your fascinating explorations, did you by any chance happen to locate that cave?"
Belgarath asked Silk.
"I more or less thought that's why you were out there sneaking around in the fog."
"The cave?" Silk said. "Oh, that's around on the north side. There's a sort of amphitheater in front of it. It's almost exactly in the middle of that face. I found that in the first 10 minutes.
Belgarath glared at him.
"It's not exactly a cave, though," Silk added. "There may be a cave back inside the peak, but the opening is more like a wide doorway. It's got pillars on each side and a familiar face above the lintel."
"Torak," Garion said with a sinking feeling.
"None other."
"Hadn't we better get started, then?" Dernick suggested. "If Xandromos is already on the island..."
He spread his hands.
"So what?"
Belden said. They all stared at the grotesque little hunchback.
"Xandromos can't go into the cave until we get there, can she?"
he asked Tseradus.
"Nay, Belden," she replied. "That is forbidden."
"Good. Let her wait, then. I'm sure she'll enjoy the anticipation. Did anybody think to bring anything to eat? I may have to be a seagull, but I don't have to eat raw fish."
Chapter 22 They waited for almost an hour, until Belden decided that by now Xandromos must be keyed to fever pitch. Garion and Zakath took advantage of the delay to put on their armor.
"I'll take a look," the dwarf said finally.
He slowly slipped into the shape of a seagull and drifted away into the fog. When he returned, he was chuckling evilly.
"I've never heard a woman use that kind of language. She even puts you to shame, Paul."
"What is she doing?" Belgarath asked him.
"She is standing outside the cave mouth, or door, or whatever you want to call it. She had about 40 grolems with her."
40? Garion exclaimed. He turned on Tseradus. "I thought you said we'd be evenly matched."
"Art thou not a match for at least 5, Belgarion?"
she asked simply.
"Well, you said had,"
Belgarath said to his brother.
"I'd say that our star-speckled friend tried to force several of her grolems to push through whatever it is that has the door sealed against her. I'm not sure if it was the force holding the door, or if Xandromos lost her temper when the grolems failed. About 5 of them are noticeably dead at the moment, and Xandromos is stalking about outside inventing swear words. All of her grolems have purple linings on the insides of their hoods, by the way."
"Sorcerers, then," Polgara said bleakly.
"Grolem sorcery is not all that profound," Belden shrugged.
"Could you see if she's got those lights under her skin?" Garion asked.
"Oh my, yes. Her face looks like a meadow full of fireflies on a summer evening. I saw something else, too. That albatross is out there." We nodded, but we didn't have time to stop and speak.
"What was he doing?" Silk asked suspiciously.
"Just hovering. You know how albatrosses are. I don't think they move their wings more than once a week. The fog is starting to thin. Why don't we just ease around and stand on one of those terraces just above that amphitheater and let this murk dissipate? Seeing a group of dark figures emerging out of the fog should give her quite a turn, wouldn't you think?"
"Did you see my baby?"
Tsinedra asked, her heart in her voice.
"He's hardly a baby anymore, little girl. He's a sturdy little lad with curls as blonde as Arion's used to be. I gathered from his expression that he's not very fond of the company he's in. And judging from the look of him, He's going to grow up to be as bad-tempered as the rest of his family. Geryon could probably go down there and hand him the sword, and then we could all just sit back and watch him deal with the problem.
I'd rather not have him start killing people until after he loses his baby teeth, Geryon said firmly. Is there anybody else there?
Judging from his wife's description, the Archduke Otrath is among the group. He's wearing a cheap crown and sort of second-hand royal robes. There's not too much in the way of intelligence in his eyes.
That one is mine, Zakath grated. I have never had the opportunity to deal with high treason on a personal level before.
His wife will be eternally in your debt, Belden grinned. She might even decide to journey to Malzeth to offer her thanks, among other things, in person. She's a lush wench, Zakath. I'd advise that you get plenty of rest.
Methinks I care not for the turn this conversation hath taken,
Zaradis said primly.
The day wears on. Let us proceed.
Anything your heart desires, me little darling, Belden grinned.
Zaradis smiled in spite of herself. Again, they all spoke with that jocular bravado. They were approaching what was probably the most important event in all of time, and making light of it was a natural human response. Silk led the way out of the niche, his soft boots making no sound on the wet stones under their feet. Geryon and Zakath, however, had to move with some care to avoid clinking. The sharply mounting stone terraces were each uniformly about 10 feet tall, but at regular intervals there were stairways leading from one terrace to the one above. Silk led them up about 3 levels, and then began circling the truncated pyramid. When they reached the northeast corner, he paused.
"We'd better be very quiet now," he whispered. "We're only about 100 yards from that amphitheater. We don't want some sharp-eared Grolem to hear us."
They crept around the corner and made their way carefully along the north face for several minutes. Then Silk stopped and leaned out over the edge to peer down into the fog.
"This is it," he whispered. "The amphitheater's a rectangular indention in the side of the peak. It runs from the beach up to that portal, or whatever you want to call it. If you look over the edge, you'll see that the terraces below us break off back there a ways. The amphitheater is right below us. We are within 100 yards of Zandramos right now."
Geryon peered down into the fog, almost wishing that by a single act of will he could brush aside the obscuring mist so that he could look at the face of his enemy.
"Steady," Belden whispered to him. "It's going to come soon enough. Let's not spoil the surprise for her."
Disjointed voices came up out of the fog. Harsh, guttural, Grolem voices. The fog seemed to muffle them, so Geryon could not pick out individual words. But he didn't really have to. They waited. The sun by now had risen above the eastern horizon, and its pale disk was faintly visible through the fog and the roiling cloud that was the aftermath of the storm. The fog began to eddy and swirl. Gradually, the mist overhead dissolved, and now Geryon could see the sky. A thick blanket of dirty-looking scud lay over the reef, but extended only a few leagues to the east. Thus it was that the sun, low on the eastern horizon, shone on the underside of the clouds and stained them an angry reddish-orange with its light. It looked almost as if the sky had taken fire.
"Colorful," Sadi murmured, nervously passing his poisoned dagger from one hand to the other.
He set his red leather case down and opened it. Then he took up the earthenware bottle, worked the stopper out, and laid it on its side.
"There should be mice on this reef," he said, "or the eggs of seabirds. Zith and her babies will be all right."
Then he straightened, carefully putting a small bag he had taken from the case in the pocket of his tunic. "A little precaution," he whispered, by way of explanation. The fog now lay beneath them like a pearly gray ocean in the shadow of the pyramid. Geryon heard a strange, melancholy cry and raised his eyes. The albatross hovered on motionless wings above the fog. Geryon peered intently down into the obscuring mist, almost absently working the leather sleeve off the hilt of his sword. The orb was glowing faintly, and its color was not blue, but an angry red, almost the color of the burning sky.
"That confirms it, old wolf," Poledra said to her husband. "The Sardaukin is in that cave."
Belgarath, silvery hair and beard glowing red in the light reflected from the clouds overhead, grunted. The fog below began to swirl, its surface looking almost like an angry sea. It thinned even more. Geryon could now see shadowy forms beneath them, hazy, indistinct, and uniformly dark. The fog was now no more than a faintly obscuring haze.
"Holy sorceress,"
a Grolem voice exclaimed in alarm.
"Look!"
A hooded figure in a shiny black satin robe spun about, and Geryon looked full into the face of the Child of Dark. He had heard the lights beneath her skin described several times, but no description had prepared him for what he now saw. The lights in Zandromos's face were not stationary, but swirled restlessly beneath her skin. In the shadow of the ancient pyramid, her features were dark, nearly invisible, but the swirling lights made it appear in the cryptic words of the Ashabine oracles, as if all the starry universe were contained in her flesh. Behind him, he heard the sharp hiss of Sinedra's indrawn breath. He turned his head and saw his little queen, dagger in hand and eyes ablaze with hatred, starting toward the stairs leading down into the amphitheater. Polgara and Velvet, obviously aware of her desperate plan, quickly restrained and disarmed her. Then Poledra stepped to the edge of the terrace.
"And so it has come at last, Zandromos," she said in a clear voice. "I was but waiting for thee to join thy friends, Poledra,"
the sorceress replied in a taunting tone.
"I was concerned for thee, fearing that thou hadst lost thy way. Now it is complete, and we may proceed in orderly fashion." "Thy concern with order is somewhat belated, Zandromos," Poledra told her. "But no matter. We have all, as was foretold, arrived at the appointed place at the appointed time. Shall we put aside all this foolishness and go inside? The universe must be growing impatient with us." "Not just yet, Poledra," Zandromos replied flatly. "How tiresome," Belgaroth's wife said wearily. "That is a failing in thee, Zandromos. Even after something obviously isn't working, thou must continue to try. Thou hast twisted and turned and tried to evade this meeting, but all in vain. And all of thine evasion hath only brought thee more quickly to this place. Thinkest thou not that it is time to forego thine entertainments and to go along gracefully?" "I do not think so, Poledra."
Poledra sighed.
"All right, Zandromos," she said in a resigned tone. "As it pleaseth thee."
She extended her arm, pointing at Geryon.
"Since thou art so bent on this, thus I summon the God Slayer."
Slowly, deliberately, Geryon reached back across his shoulder and wrapped his hand about the hilt of his sword. It made an angry hiss as it slid from its sheath, and it was already flaming an incandescent blue as it emerged. Geryon's mind was icy calm now. All doubt and fear were gone, even as they had been at Tol Mishrak, and the spirit of the Child of Light possessed him utterly. He took the sword hilt in both hands and slowly raised it until the flaming blade was pointed at the fiery clouds overhead.
"This is thy fate, Zandramos,"
he roared in an awful voice, the archaic words coming unbidden to his lips.
"That has yet to be determined, Belgarian."
Zandramos's tone was defiant, as might be expected. But there was something else behind it.
"Fate is not always so easily read."
She made an imperious gesture, and her groms formed up into a phalanx around her and began to intone a harsh chant in an ancient and hideous language.
"Get back,"
Polgara warned sharply, and she, her parents, and Belden stepped to the edge of the terrace. Flickering faintly, an inky shadow began to appear at the very edge of Geryon's vision, and he began to feel an obscure sense of dread. "Watch yourselves," he quietly warned his friends. "I think she's starting one of those illusions we were talking about last night." Then he felt a powerful surge and heard a roar of sound. A wave of sheer darkness rolled out from the extended hands of the Grolems massed around Zandramos, but the wave shattered into black fragments that sizzled and skittered around the amphitheater like frightened mice as the four sorcerers blew it apart almost contemptuously with a single word spoken in unison. Several of the Grolems collapsed, writhing to the stone floor, and most of the rest of them staggered back, their faces suddenly pasty white. Belden cackled evilly.
"And would you like to try it again, darling?"
he taunted Zandramos.
"If that's your intent, you should have brought more Grolems. You're using them up at a fearful rate, don't you know?"
"I wish you wouldn't do that," Belgareth said to him.
"So does she, I'll wager. She takes herself very seriously, and a little ridicule always sets that sort off their pace."
Without exchanging expression, Zandramos hurled a fireball at the dwarf, but he brushed it aside, as if it were no more than an annoying insect. Geryon quite suddenly understood. The sudden sheet of darkness and the fireball were not intended seriously. They were no more than a subterfuge, a way to distract attention from that shadow at the edge of vision. The sorceress of Darshiva smiled a chill little smile.
"No matter,"
she shrugged.
"I was only testing you, my droll little hunchback. Keep laughing, Belden. I like to see people die happy."
"Truly," he agreed. "Smile a bit yourself, me darling, and have a bit of a look around. You might say goodbye to the sun while you're at it, for I don't think you'll be seeing it for much longer."
"Are all these threats really necessary?" Belgareth asked wearily.
"It's customary," Belden told him. "Insults and boasting are a common prelude to more serious business. Besides, she started it."
He looked down at Zandramos's Grolems, who had started to move menacingly forward.
"I guess it's time, though. Shall we go downstairs then and prepare a big pot of Grolem stew? I like mine chopped rather fine."
He extended his hand, snapped his fingers, and wrapped the hand around the hilt of a hook-pointed Ulgo knife. With Geryon in the lead, they walked purposefully to the head of the stairs and started down, as the Grolems, with a variety of weapons in their hands, rushed to the bottom.
"Get back,"
Silk snapped at Velvet, who had resolutely joined them with one of her daggers held professionally low.
"Not a chance,"
she said crisply.
"I'm protecting my investment."
"What investment?"
"We can talk about it later. I'm busy right now."
The Grolem leading the charge was a huge man, almost as big as Toth. He was swinging a massive axe, and his eyes were filled with madness. When he was perhaps 5 feet from Geryon, Tsadi stepped up to the Riven King's shoulder and hurled a fistful of strangely colored powder full into the ascending Grolem's face. The Grolem shook his head, pawing at his eyes. Then he sneezed. And then his eyes filled with horror, and he screamed. Howling in terror, he dropped his axe, spun, and bolted back down, shouldering his companions off of the steps as he fled.
When he reached the floor of the amphitheater, he did not stop, but ran toward the sea. He floundered out into the waist-deep water and then stepped off the edge of an unseen terrace, lurking beneath the surface. It did not appear that he knew how to swim.
"I thought you were out of that powder," Silk said to Tsadi, even as he made a long, smooth overhand cast with one of his daggers.
A Grolem stumbled back, plucking at the dagger hilt protruding from his chest, missed his footing, and fell heavily backward down the stairway.
"I always keep a bit for contingencies," Tsadi replied, ducking under a sword swipe and deftly slicing a Grolem across the belly with his poisoned dagger.
The Grolem stiffened, then slowly toppled out off the side of the staircase. A number of black-robed men, seeking to surprise them from the rear, were clambering up the rough sides of the stairway. Velvet knelt and coolly drove one of her daggers into the upturned face of a Grolem on the verge of reaching the top. With a hoarse cry, he clutched at his face and fell backward, sweeping several of his companions off of the wall as he plunged down. Then the blonde Drasnian girl darted to the other side of the stairs, shaking out her silken cord. She deftly looped it about the neck of a Grolem in the act of scrambling up onto the steps. She stepped under his flailing arms, turned until they were back to back, and leaned forward. The helpless Grolem's feet came up off the step, and he clutched at the cord about his neck with both hands. His feet kicked futilely at the air for a few moments, his face turning black. Then he went limp. Velvet turned back, unlooped her cord, and coolly kicked the inert body off the edge. Durnik and Toth had moved up to take positions beside Garion and Zakath, and the four of them moved implacably down the stairs, step by step, chopping and smashing at the black-robed figures rushing up to meet them. Durnik's hammer seemed only slightly less dreadful than the sword of the Riven King. The Grolems fell before them as they moved inexorably down the stairs. Toth was chopping methodically with Durnik's axe, his face as expressionless as that of a man felling a tree. Zakath was a fencer, and he feinted and parried with his massive, though nearly weightless, sword. His thrusts were quick and usually lethal. The steps below the dreadful quartet were soon littered with twisted bodies and were running with rivulets of blood.
"Watch your footing," Durnik warned as he crushed another Grolem's skull. "Our steps are getting slippery."
Garion swept off another Grolem head. It bounced like a child's ball down the steps even as the body toppled off the side of the stairway. Garion risked a quick look back over his shoulder. Belgrath and Belden had joined Velvet to help the girl repel the black-robed men scrambling up the sides of the steps. Belden seemed to take vicious delight in driving his hook-pointed knife into Grolem eyes, then, with a sharp twist and a jerk, he would pull out sizable gobs of brains. Belgrath, his thumbs tucked into his rope belt, waited calmly. When a Grolem's head appeared above the edge of the stair, the old man would draw back his foot and kick the priest of Torak full in the face. Since it was a 30-foot drop from the stairs to the stones of the amphitheater, few of the Grolems he kicked off the side of the stairs tried the climb a second time. When they reached the foot of the stairs, scarcely any of Zandramas's Grolems survived. With his usual prudence, Tsadi darted around first one side of the stairway and then the other, coolly sinking his poisoned dagger into the bodies of those Grolems who had fallen to the amphitheater floor, the inert dead as well as the groaning injured. Zandramas seemed somewhat taken aback by the sheer violence of her foe's descent. She held her ground nonetheless, drawing herself up in scornful defiance. Standing behind her, his mouth agape with terror, stood a man in a cheap crown and somewhat shop-worn regal robes. His features bore a faint resemblance to those of Zakath, so Garion assumed that he was the Archduke Otrath. And then at last, Garion beheld his own young son. He had avoided looking at the boy during the bloody descent, since he had been unsure of what his own reaction might have been at a time when his concentration was vital. As Belden had said, Garin was no longer a baby. His blonde curls gave his face a softness, but there was no softness in his eyes as he met his father's gaze. Garin was quite obviously consumed with hatred for the woman, who firmly held his arm in her grasp. Gravely, Garin raised his sword to his visor in salute, and just as gravely, Garin lifted his free hand in response. Then the Riven King began an implacable advance, pausing only long enough to kick an unattached Grolem head out of his way. The uncertainty he had felt back in Dal Perivor had vanished now. Sandoromos stood no more than a few yards away, and the fact that she was a woman no longer mattered. He raised his flaming sword and continued his advance. The flickering shadow along the periphery of his vision grew darker, and he hesitated as his sense of dread increased. Try though he might, he could not stifle it. He faltered. The shadow, vague at first, began to coalesce into a hideous face that towered behind the black-robed sorceress. The eyes were soullessly blank, and the mouth gaped open in an expression of unspeakable loss, as if the owner of the face had been plunged into a horror beyond imagining from a place of light and glory. That loss, however, bespoke no compassion or gentleness, but rather expressed the implacable need of the hideous being to find others to share its misery.
"Behold, the King of Hell!"
Zandramos cried triumphantly.
"Flee now and live a few moments longer, ere he pulls you all down into eternal darkness, eternal flames, and eternal despair."
Garin stopped. He could not advance on that ultimate horror. And then a voice came to him out of his memories. And with the voice, there came an image. He seemed to be standing in a damp clearing in a forest somewhere. A light, drizzling rain was falling from a heavy nighttime sky, and the leaves underfoot were wet and soggy. Ariond, all unconcerned, was speaking to them. It had happened, Garin realized, just after their first encounter with Zandramos, who had assumed the shape of the dragon to attack them.
"But the fire wasn't real,"
the young man was explaining.
"Didn't you all know that?"
He looked slightly surprised at their failure to understand.
"It was only an illusion. That's all evil ever really is, an illusion. I'm sorry if any of you were worried, but I didn't have time to explain."
That was the key. Garin understood now. Hallucination was the product of derangement. Illusion was not. He was not going mad. The face of the King of Hell was no more real than had been the illusion of Errol that Sinedra had encountered in the forest below Kel. The only weapon the Child of Dark had to counter the Child of Light was illusion, a subtle trickery directed at the mind. It was a powerful weapon, but very fragile. One ray of light could destroy it. He started forward again.
"Garin!"
Silk cried.
"Ignore the face," Garin told him. "It isn't real. Zandramos is trying to frighten us into madness. The face isn't there. It doesn't even have as much substance as a shadow."
Zandramos flinched, and the enormous face behind her wavered and vanished. Her eyes darted this way and that, lingering, Garin seemed to perceive, upon the portal leading into the cave. As surely as if he could see it, Garin knew that there was something in that cave. Something which was Zandramos's last line of defense. Then, seemingly all unconcerned by the obliteration of the weapon that had always served the Child of Dark so well, she made a quick gesture to her remaining Grolems.
"No."
It was the light, clear voice of the Seeress of Kel.
"I cannot permit this. The issue must be decided by the choice, not by senseless brawling. Put up thy sword, Belgarian of Riva, and withdraw thy minions, Zandramos of Darshiva."
Garin found that the muscles of his legs had suddenly cramped, and that he could no longer move even one step. Painfully, he twisted around. He saw Serratus descending the stairs, guided now by Ariond. Immediately behind her came Aunt Paul, Poledra, and the Riven Queen.
"The task you both share here,"
Serratus continued, in an echoing choral voice,
"is not to destroy each other. For should it come to pass that one of you destroyeth the other, your tasks will remain uncompleted, and I also will be unable to complete mine. Thus, all that is, all that was, and all that is yet to be will forever perish. Put up thy sword, Belgarion, and send away thy grolems, Zandramas. Let us go, even into the place which is no more, and make our choices. The universe grows weary of our delay."
Regretfully, Geryon sheathed his sword, but the sorceress of Darshiva's eyes narrowed.
"Kill her,"
she commanded her grolems in a chillingly flat voice.
"Kill the blind Dalesian witch, in the name of the new god of Angarak."
The remaining grolems, their faces filled with religious exultation, started toward the foot of the stairs. Ariond sighed, and resolutely stepped forward to place his body in front of that of Serratus.
"That will not be necessary, bearer of the orb,"
Serratus told him. She bowed her head slightly, and the choral voice swelled to a crescendo. The grolems faltered and then began to grope around, staring with unseeing eyes at the daylight around them.
"It's the enchantment again," Zakath whispered. "The same one that surrounded Kel. They are blind."
This time, however, what the grolems saw in their blindness was not the vision of the face of God that the gentle old priest of Torak they had met in the sheep camp above Kel had seen, but something altogether different. The enchantment, it appeared, could cut two ways. The grolems cried out first in alarm, then in fright. Then their cries became screams, and they turned, stumbling over each other and even crawling on hands and knees to escape that which they saw. They scrambled blindly down to the water's edge, obviously bent on following the hulking grolem into whose face Tzadi had thrown that strange powder of his. They floundered out now into the now gently rolling waves, and one by one stepped off into deep water. A few could swim, but not very many. Those who could swam desperately out to sea and inevitable death. Those who could not sank beneath the surface, their imploring hands reaching upward even after their heads had gone under. Columns of bubbles rose to the top of the dark water for a few moments, and then they stopped. The albatross, its great wings motionless, drifted over them for a moment, and then returned to hover over the amphitheater. Chapter 23.
"And now art thou, as thou hast ever chosen to be, alone, child of dark,"
Serratus said sternly.
"The ones who were here with me were of no moment, Serratus,"
Zandramas replied indifferently.
"They have served their purpose, and I no longer need them."
"Art thou then ready to enter through the portal into the place which is no more, to stand in the presence of the Sardian, there to make thy choice?"
"Of course, holy Seeress,"
Zandramas acquiesced with surprising mildness.
"Gladly will I join with the Child of Light, that together we may enter the Temple of Torak."
"Watch her, Geryon," Silk whispered. "The whole tone of this is wrong. She's up to something." But Serratus, it appeared, had also detected the ruse.
"Thy sudden acceptance is puzzling, Zandramas. Vainly hast thou striven for all these weary months to avoid this meeting, and now thou wouldst rush eagerly into the grotto? What hath so altered thee? Doth perchance some unseen peril lurk within yon grot? Seekest thou still to lure the child of light to his doom, thinking thereby to avoid the necessity of the choice?
The answer to thy question, blind witch, doth lie behind that portal,
Sandramos replied in a harsh voice. She turned her glittering face toward Geryon.
Surely the great god-slayer is without fear? Or is he who slowed Torak become of a sudden timid and fearful? What threat could I, a mere woman, pose to the mightiest warrior in the world? Let us then investigate this grotto together. Confidently will I deliver my safety into thy hands, Belgerian.
It may not be so, Zandramas,
the seeress of Kel declared.
It is too late now for subterfuge and deceit. Only the choice will free thee now.
She paused and briefly bowed her head. Again Geryon heard that choral murmuring.
Ah,
she said at last.
Now we understand. The passage in the Book of the Heavens was obscure, but now it is clear.
She turned toward the portal.
Come forth, demon lord. Lurk not in darkness awaiting prey, but come forth, that we may see thee.
No!
Sandramos cried hoarsely. But it was too late. Reluctantly, almost as if being driven, the battered and half-crippled dragon limped out of the grotto, roaring and belching billows of flame and smoke.
Not again,
Zakath groaned. Geryon, however, saw more than just the dragon. Even as in the snow-clogged forest outside Val Alorn, when he had seen the image of Barak superimposed upon that of the dreadful bear rushing to his rescue after he had speared the boar when he was no more than 14, he now saw the form of the demon lord Murja within the shape of the dragon. Murja, archfoe of Nahaz, the demon that had borne the shrieking Irvon into the eternal pit of hell. Murja, who, with a half-dozen snake-like arms, grasped a huge sword, a sword that Geryon recognized all too well. The demon lord, encased in the form of the dragon, strode forward with monstrous steps, wielding Threkkoru, Torak's dread sword of shadows. The burning red clouds overhead erupted with lightning as the hideously twinned beast came at them.
Spread out, Geryon shouted. Silk, tell them what to do.
He drew a deep breath as great bolts of lightning streaked down from the roiling red sky above to crash against the sides of the terraced pyramid with earth-shattering claps of thunder.
Let's go,
Geryon cried to Zakath, as he once more drew iron-gripped sword. But then he paused, dumbfounded. Poledra, as calmly as she would if crossing a meadow, approached the awful monstrosity.
Thy master is the Lord of Deception, Murja,
she said to the suddenly immobilized creature before her.
But it is time for deceit to end. Thou wilt speak only truth. What is thy purpose here? What is the purpose of all of thy kind in this place?
The demon lord, frozen within the form of the dragon, snarled its hatred as it twisted and writhed, attempting to break free.
Speak, Murja,
Poledra commanded. Did anyone have that kind of power?
I will not,
Murja spat out the words.
Thou wilt,
Geryon's grandmother said, in a dreadfully quiet voice. Murja shrieked then, a shriek of total agony.
What is thy purpose?
Poledra insisted.
I serve the king of hell,
the demon cried.
And what is the purpose of the king of hell here?
He would possess the stones of power,
Murja howled.
And why?
that he may break his chains, the chains in which a cursed Ull bound him, long ere any of this was made.
Wherefore hast thou then aided the child of Dark? And wherefore didst thy foe Nahaz aid the disciple of Torak? Didst not thy master know that each of them sought to raise a god which would even more securely bind him?
What they sought was of no moment,
Morja snarled.
Nahaz and I contended with each other in truth, but our contention was not on behalf of Mad Irvan or sluttish Sandramos. In the instant that he took up the two stones, would he become the new god? His chains would break, and he would contend with Ull as an equal, nay, an even mightier god. And all that is, was, or will be, would be his, and his alone.
And what then was to be the fate of the Child of Dark, or the Disciple of Torak?
They were to be our rewards. Even now doth Nahaz feed eternally upon Mad Irvan in the darkest pit of hell, even as I shall feed upon Sandramos. The ultimate reward of the King of Hell is eternal torment.
The sorceress of Darshiva gasped in horror as she heard her soul's fate so cruelly pronounced.
Thou canst not stop me, Poledra,
Marja taunted.
For the King of Hell hath strengthened my hand.
Thy hand, however, is confined in the body of this rude beast, Poledra said. Thou hast made thy choice, and in this place, a choice once made, cannot be unmade. Here wilt thou contend alone, and thine only ally will not be the King of Hell, but no more than this mindless creature which thou hast chosen.
The demon raised its dreadful fang-filled muzzle with a great howl, and it struggled, heaving its vast shoulders this way and that, as it desperately tried to wrench itself free of the shape that enclosed it.
Does this mean we have to fight them both?
Zakath asked Geryon, in a shaking voice.
I'm afraid so.
Geryon, have you lost your mind?
It's what we do, Zakath. At least Poledra has limited Morja's power. I don't know how, but she has. Since he doesn't have his full powers, we at least have a chance against him. Let's get at it.
Geryon clapped down his visor and strode forward, swinging his flaming sword before him. Silk and the others had separated, and they were approaching the dragon from the sides and from the rear. As he and Zakath warily moved in, Geryon saw something that might be an even greater advantage. The melding of the primitive mind of the dragon and the age-old one of the demon was not complete. The dragon, with stubborn stupidity, could only focus her single eye upon those enemies who stood directly before her, and she charged on, unmindful of Geryon's friends moving toward her flanks. Morja, however, was all too much aware of the dangers advancing from the sides and from the rear. The division of the unnaturally joined mind of the vast bat-winged creature gave it a kind of uncharacteristic hesitation, indecision, even. Then Silk, the sword of a fallen Grolem in his hands, darted in from the rear and chopped manfully at the writhing tail. The dragon bellowed in pain, and flames burst from her gaping mouth. Overriding what little control Morja exerted upon her, she wheeled clumsily to respond to Silk's attack. The little thief, however, skipped nimbly out of her way, even as the others dashed in to attack her flanks. Durnik rhythmically hammered on one exposed flank, while Toth chopped no less rhythmically at the other. A desperate plan came unbidden to Geryon as he saw that the dragon had turned almost completely around to meet Silk's attack.
"Work on her tail!"
he shouted to Zakath. He backed off a few paces to give himself running room, then lumbered forward, his movements made awkward by his armor. He leaped over the slashing tail and ran up the dragon's back.
"Geryon!"
he heard Sinedra scream with horror. He ignored her frightened cry and continued to scramble up the scaly back until he was finally able to plant his feet on the dragon's shoulders between the bat-like wings. The dragon, he knew, would not fear or even feel the strokes of his burning sword. Morja, however, would. He raised Iron Grip's sword and struck a two-handed blow at the base of the scaly neck. The dragon, weaving her fearsome head and breathing fire and smoke, as she sought out those who were attacking her, paid no heed. Morja, however, screamed in agony as the power of the orb seared him. That was their advantage. Left to herself, the dragon was incapable of meeting their many-pronged attack. It was the added intelligence of the demon lord that made her so dangerous in this situation. But Geryon had seen evidence in the past that the orb could inflict intolerable agony upon a demon. In that respect, it had even more power than did a god. Demons fled from the presence of the gods, but they could not flee from the chastisement of Aldur's orb.
"Hotter!"
he commanded the stone as he raised his blade again. He struck and struck and struck again. The great blade no longer bounced off the dragon's scales, but seared its way through them to bite into the dragon's flesh. The half-indistinct image of Morja, encased in the dragon, shrieked as the sword cut into his neck, even as it slashed at that of the dragon. Almost in mid-stroke, Geryon reversed his sword and, grasping the crosspiece of the hilt, drove it down into the dragon's back between the vast shoulders. Morja screamed. Geryon wrenched the sword back and forth, tearing the wound even wider. Even the dragon felt that. She screamed. Geryon raised his sword again, and once again sank it into the bleeding wound. Deeper, this time, the dragon and Morja screamed in unison. Ludicrously, Geryon remembered a time in his bygone youth when he had watched old Kralto digging holes for fence posts. He consciously imitated the old farm worker's rhythmic motion, raising his reversed sword high overhead as Kralto had his shovel and driving the blade down into the dragon's flesh. With each driving blow, the wound grew deeper, and blood gushed and spurted from the quivering flesh. He momentarily saw the white of bone and altered his point of aim. Not even Iron Grip's sword could shear through that tree trunk-sized backbone. His friends had momentarily fallen back, astonished at the Riven King's insane-appearing audacity. Then they saw that the dragon's almost serpent-like head was raised high in the air as she tried desperately to writhe her neck around to bite at the tormentor, digging a huge hole between her shoulder blades. They rushed back into the attack, hacking and stabbing at the softer scales, covering the dragon's throat, belly, and flanks. Darting in and out quickly to avoid being trampled by the huge beast, Silk, Velvet, and Tzadi attacked the unprotected underside of the distracted dragon. Durnik was steadily pounding on the dragon's side, methodically breaking ribs one by one, as Toth chopped at the other side. Belgarath and Poledra, once again as wolves, were gnawing on the writhing tail. Then Geryon saw what he had been searching for, the hawser-like tendon leading down into one of the dragon's huge wings. "Hotter!" he shouted again at the orb. The sword flared anew, and this time Geryon did not strike. Instead, he set the edge of his weapon against the tendon and began to saw back and forth with it, burning through the tough ligament rather than chopping. The tendon, finally severed, snapped, its cut ends slithering snake-like back into the bleeding flesh. The bellow of pain that emerged from that flame-filled mouth was shattering. The dragon lurched, then fell, thrashing its huge limbs in terrible agony. Geryon was thrown clear when the dragon fell. Desperately he rolled, trying to get away from those flailing claws. Then Zakath was there, yanking him to his feet.
"You are insane, Geryon," he shouted in a shrill voice. "Are you all right?"
"I'm fine," Geryon said in a tight voice. "Let's finish it."
Thoth, however, was already there. In the very shadow of the dragon's huge head he stood, his feet planted wide apart, chopping at the base of the dragon's throat. Great gushes of blood spurted from severed arteries as the huge mute, his heavy shoulders surging, sought to find and cut the barrel-like windpipe. Despite the concerted efforts of Geryon and his friends, there had been little more than pain before. Thoth's single-minded attack, however, threatened the dragon's very life. Were he to succeed in severing, or even broaching, the thick gristle of that windpipe, the dragon would die, choking for lack of breath, or drowning in her own blood. She clawed her way back onto her forelegs and reared high over the huge mute.
"Thoth!" Durnick shouted. "Get out of there! She's going to strike!"
But it was not the fanged mouth that struck. Dimly, within the bleeding body of the dragon, Geryon saw the indistinct shape of Murja, desperately raised Trekgoru, the Sword of Shadows. Then the demon lord thrust out with the sword. The blade, as if insubstantial, emerged from the dragon's chest and, as smoothly, plunged into Thoth to emerge from his back. The mute stiffened, then slid limply off the sword, unable even in death to cry out.
"No!"
Durnick roared in a voice filled with indescribable loss. Geryon's mind went absolutely cold.
"Keep her teeth off of me," he told Zakath in a flat, unemotional tone. Then he dashed forward, reversing his sword once again in preparation for a thrust such as he had never delivered before. He aimed that thrust not at the wound Thoth had opened, but at the dragon's broad chest instead. Trekgoru flickered out to ward him off, but Geryon parried that desperate defensive stroke, then set his shoulder against the massive crosspiece of his sword's hilt. He fixed the now shrinking demon with a look of pure hatred, and then he drove his sword into the dragon's chest with all of his strength, and the great surge, as the orb unleashed its power, almost staggered him. The sword of the Riven King slid smoothly into the dragon's heart, like a stick into water. The awful bellowing from both the dragon and the demon lord broke off suddenly, in a kind of gurgling sigh. Grimly, Geryon wrenched his sword free and stepped clear of the convulsing beast. Then, like a burning house collapsing in on itself, the dragon crumpled to the ground, twitched a few times, and was still. Geryon wearily turned. Thoth's face was calm, but blind Seradus knelt on one side of his body, and Durnick on the other. They were both weeping openly. High overhead, the albatross cried out once, a cry of pain and loss. Seradus was weeping, her blindfold wet with her tears. The smoky-looking orange sky roiled and tumbled overhead. Inky black patches lay in the folds of the clouds, shifting, coiling, undulating as the clouds, still stained on their undersides by the new-risen sun, writhed in the sky above and flinched and shuddered as they begot drunken-appearing lightning that staggered down through the murky air to strike savagely at the altar of the one-eyed god on the pinnacle above. Seradus was weeping. The sharply regular stones that floored the amphitheater were still darkly wet from the clinging fog that had enveloped the reef before dawn and the downpour of yesterday. The white speckles in that iron-hard stone glittered like stars under their sheen of moisture.
Saradus was weeping. Geryon drew in a deep breath and looked around the amphitheater. It was not as large, perhaps, as he had first imagined. Certainly not large enough to contain what had happened here. But then, all the world would probably not have been large enough to contain that. The faces of his companions, bathed in the fiery light from the sky, and periodically glowing dead white in the intense flashes of the stuttering lightning, seemed awed by the enormity of what had just happened. The amphitheater was littered with dead golems, shrunken black patches lying on the stones or sprawled in boneless-looking clumps on the stairs. Geryon heard a peculiar, voiceless rumble that died off into something almost like a sigh. He looked in curiously at the dragon. Its tongue protruded from its gaping mouth, and its reptilian eyes stared blankly at him. The sound he had heard had come from that vast carcass. The beast's entrails, still unaware that they, like the rest of the dragon, were dead, continued their methodical work of digestion. Zandramos stood frozen in shock. The beast she had raised and the demon she had sent to possess it were both dead, and her desperate effort to evade the necessity of standing powerless and defenseless in the place of the choice had crumbled and fallen as a child's castle of sand crumbles before the encroaching waves. Geryon's son looked upon his father with unquestioning trust and pride, and Geryon took a certain comfort in that clear-eyed gaze. Saradus was weeping. All else in Geryon's mind was drawn from reflection and random impressions. The one incontrovertible fact, however, was that the Seeress of Kell was crushed by her grief. At this particular time, she was the most important person in the universe, and perhaps it had always been so. It might very well be, Geryon thought, that the world had been created for the one express purpose of bringing this frail girl to this place, at this time, to make this single choice. But could she do that now? Might it not be that the death of her guide and protector, the one person in all the world she had truly loved, had rendered her incapable of making the choice? Saradus was weeping, and so long as she wept, the minutes ticked by. Geryon saw now, as clearly as if he were reading in that book of the heavens which guided the seers, that the time of the meeting and of the choice was not only this particular day, but would come in a specific instant of this day. And if Saradus, bowed down by her unbearable grief, were unable to choose in that instant, all that had been, all that was, and all that was yet to be, would shimmer and vanish like an ephemeral dream. Her weeping must cease, or all would be forever lost. It began with a clear-toned single voice, a voice that rose and rose in elegiac sadness, that contained within it the sum of human woe. Then other voices emerged singly or in trios or in octets to join that aching song. The chorus of the group mind of the seers plumbed the depths of the grief of the Seeress of Kell, and then sank in an unbearable diminuendo of blackest despair, and faded off into a silence more profound than the silence of the grave. Saradus was weeping, but she did not weep alone. Her entire race wept with her. That lone voice began again, and the melody was similar to the one that had just died away. To Geryon's untrained ear, it seemed almost the same, but a subtle chord change had somehow taken place, and as the other voices joined in, more chords insinuated themselves into the song, and the grief and unutterable despair were questioned in the final notes. Yet once again, the song began. not this time with a single voice, but with a mighty chord that seemed to shake the very roots of heaven with its triumphant affirmation. The melody remained basically the same, but what had begun as a dirge was now an exultation. Tiretus gently laid Toth's hand on his motionless chest, smoothed his hair, and groped across his body to touch Durnik's tear-wet face consolingly. She rose, no longer weeping, and Geryon's fears dissolved and faded as the morning fog that had obscured the reef had faded beneath the onslaught of the sun.
"Go,"
she said in a resolute voice, pointing at the now unguarded portal.
"The time approaches. Go, thou child of light, and thou, child of dark, even into the grot, for we have choices to make which, once made, may never be unmade. Come ye with me, therefore, into the place which is no more, there to decide the fate of all men."
And with firm and unfaltering step, the seeress of Kel led the way toward that portal surmounted by the stony image of the face of Torak. Geryon found himself powerless in the grip of that clear voice, and he fell in beside satin-robed Zandromos to follow the slender seeress. He felt a faint brush against his armored right shoulder as he and the Child of Dark entered the portal. It was almost with a wry amusement that he realized that the forces controlling this meeting were not so entirely sure of themselves. They had placed a barrier between him and the sorceress of Darshiva. Zandromos's unprotected throat lay quite easily within the reach of his vengeful hands, but the barrier made her as unassailable as if she had been on the far side of the moon. Faintly, he was aware that the others were coming up behind, his friends following him, and Geryon and the violently trembling Otrath trailing after Zandromos.
"This need not be so, Bel Geryon of Riva," Zandromos whispered urgently. "Will we, the two most powerful ones in all of the universe, submit to the haphazard choice of this brain-sickly girl? Let us bestow our choices upon ourselves. Thus will we both become gods. Easily will we be able to set aside Ul and the others and rule all creation jointly."
The swirling lights beneath the skin of her face spun faster now, and her eyes glowed red.
"Once we have achieved divinity, thou canst put aside thine earthly wife, who is not after all human, and thou and I could mate. Thou couldst father a race of gods upon me, Bel Geryon, and we could sate each other with unearthly delights. Thou wilt find me fair, King of Riva, as all men have, and I will consume thy days with the passion of gods, and we will share in the meeting of light and dark."
Geryon was startled, even a little awed by the single-mindedness of the spirit of the Child of Dark. The thing was as implacable and as unchangeable as adamantine rock. He perceived that it did not change because it could not. He began to grope his way toward something that seemed significant. Light could change. Every day was a testimony to that. Dark could not. Then it was at last that he understood the true meaning of the eternal division which had rent the universe apart. The dark sought immobile stasis. The light sought progression. The dark crouched in a perceived perfection. The light, however, moved on, informed by the concept of perfectibility. When Geryon spoke, it was not in reply to the blatant inducements of Zandromos, but rather to the spirit of dark itself.
"It will change, you know. Nothing you can do will stop me from believing that. Torak offered to be my father, and now Zandromos offers to be my wife. I rejected Torak, and I reject Zandromos. You cannot lock me into immobility. If I change only one little thing, you have lost. Go stop the tide if you can, and leave me alone to do my work.
The gasp that came from the mouth of Zandromas was more than human. Geryon's sudden understanding had actually stung the dark, not merely its instrument. He felt a faint, almost feather-like probing, and made no effort to repel it. Zandromas hissed, her eyes aflame with hate-filled frustration.
"Didn't you find what you wanted?" Geryon asked.
The voice that came from her lips was dry, unemotional.
"You'll have to make your choice eventually, you know," it said.
The voice that came from Geryon's lips was not his own, and it was just as dry and clinical.
"There's plenty of time. My instrument will choose when it is needful."
"A clever move, but it does not yet signify the end of the game."
"Of course not. The last move lies in the hands of the Seeress of Kell."
"So be it, then."
They were walking down a long, musty-smelling corridor.
"I absolutely hate this," Geryon heard Silk murmur from behind him. "It's going to be all right, Keldar,"
Velvet told the little man comfortingly.
"I won't let anything happen to you."
Then the corridor opened out into a submerged grotto. The walls were rough, irregular, for this was not a construction but a natural cavern. Water oozed down a far wall to trickle endlessly with silvery note into a dark pool. The grotto had a faintly reptilian smell overlaid by the odor of long-dead meat, and the floor was littered with gnawed white bones. By some ironic twist, the lair of the dragon god had become the lair of the dragon herself. No better guard had been necessary to protect this place. On the near wall stood a massive throne carved from a single rock, and before the throne there was one of the now all too familiar altars. Lying on the center of that altar was an oblong stone somewhat larger than a man's head. The stone glowed red, and its ugly light illuminated the grotto. Just to one side of the altar lay a human skeleton, its bony arm extended in a gesture of longing. Geryon frowned. Some sacrifice to Torak, perhaps? Some victim of the dragon? Then he knew. It was the Melsine scholar who had stolen the Sardian from the university and fled with it to this place to die here, in unthinking adoration of the stone that had killed him. Just over his shoulder, Geryon heard a sudden animal-like snarl coming from the orb, and a similar sound came from the red stone, the Sardian, which lay on the altar. There was a confused babble of sound, in a multitude of languages, some drawn, for all Geryon knew, from the farthest reaches of the universe. Flickering streaks of blue shot up through the milky red Sardian. And, similarly, angry red bathed the orb in undulant waves as all the conflicts of all of the ages came together in this small, confined space.
"Control it, Geryon," Belgareth said sharply. "If you don't, they will destroy each other, and the universe as well."
Geryon reached back over his shoulder and placed his marked palm over the orb, speaking silently to the vengeful stone.
"Not yet. All in good time."
He could not have explained why he had chosen those precise words. Grumbling almost like a petulant child, the orb fell silent, and the Sardian also grudgingly broke off its snarl. The lights, however, continued to stain the surfaces of both stones.
"You were quite good back there,"
the voice in Geryon's mind congratulated him.
"Our enemy is a bit off balance now. Don't get overconfident, though. We are at a slight disadvantage here because the spirit of the Child of Dark is very strong in this grotto." "Why didn't you tell me that before?"
would you have paid any attention? Listen carefully, Geryon. My opposite has agreed that we should leave the matter in Saradus's hands. Zandramas, however, has made no such commitment. She's very likely to make one last attempt. Put yourself between her and the Sardian. No matter what you have to do, don't let her reach that stone. All right, Geryon said bleakly. He reasoned that attempting to edge into position inch by inch would not deceive the sorceress of Darsheva as to his intent. Instead, quite calmly and deliberately, he simply stepped in front of the altar, drew his sword, and set its point on the floor of the grotto in front of him, with his crossed hands resting on the pommel.
"What art thou about?"
Zandramas demanded, in a harsh, suspicious tone of voice. "You know exactly what I'm doing, Zandramas," Geryon replied. "The two spirits have agreed to let Saradus decide between them. I haven't heard you agree yet. Do you still think you can avoid the choice?" Her light-speckled face twisted with hatred.
"Thou wilt pay for this, Belgerion," she answered. "All that thou art, and all that thou lovest, will perish here."
"That's for Saradus to decide, not you. In the meantime, nobody is going to touch the Sardian until after Saradus makes her choice." Zandramas ground her teeth in sudden, impotent fury. And then Poledra came closer, her tawny hair stained by the light of the Sardian. "Very well done, young wolf," she said to Geryon.
"Thou no longer hast the power, Poledra."
The strangely abstracted words came from Zandramas's unmoving mouth. "Point," the familiar dry voice spoke through Poledra's lips. "I perceive no point."
"That's because you have always discarded your instruments when you were finished with them. Poledra was the child of light at Vomimbre. She was even able to defeat Torak there, if only temporarily. Once that power is bestowed, it can never be wholly taken away. Did not her control over the demon lord prove that to you?"
Geryon was almost staggered by that. Poledra, the child of light during that dreadful battle 500 years ago. The voice went on.
"Do you acknowledge the point?"
it asked its opposite. "What difference can it make? The game will be played out soon."
"I claim point. Our rules required that you acknowledge it."
"Very well. I acknowledge the point. You have really become quite childish about this, you know."